I have two questions which are the same. Explain the relationship between EBI and Helios, both scientific and organizational.
The Helios program consists both of the biology that you've heard some about today, as well as non-biological aspects. So developing photovoltaic cells. Steve talked quite a bit about this. At LBL, we consider Helios to be the umbrella over all of the projects that fall in this area of renewable energy. So there is a relationship. We consider the EBI to be part of Helios under the broader umbrella of the Helios project.
We're also actually in the energy conservation that you heard about, and also a new initiative that actually sprang from the ground up in the university and its Berkeley lab on more robust climate change predictions is also going to be part of the formula.
I'm trying to some of the topics are starting to recur, so let me just give myself a minute to get organized here. How much does carbon sequestration help with pollution? How cost effective is it, Steve? David, after that.
Yeah, there are two estimates. One is the cost of capturing the carbon either by gasifying the coal or by capturing it afterwards at the stack. There are estimates that range on sort of wholesale costs of on the order of 25-30%. There's a wild card, and the wild card is legal challenges to sequestration, because there may be many people who would object to putting thousands of pounds per square inch of carbon dioxide in their backyard if there's any chance that it might bubble back up. So that's something that could easily double the cost, and if it doubles the cost, I'm afraid it will not happen.
So actually BP asked us to mount an investigation of the utility of biological carbon sequestration, and so we'll have a program at least in that area. And to put it, I think it can be quite promising in certain respects, and that is if you plant a redwood tree, that tree should outlive all fossil fuels, so the fossil fuel does remain out of the system. But we need to really understand competing land use, because the rate of growth of things like redwoods is quite slow relative to the rate of growth of seaboard grasses. So there's some trade-off between using the land annually to make carbon neutral fuels versus long-term sequestration in slow-growing species, but we're going to be looking at that as one of the activities in the EBS.
There's a lot of ongoing research on carbon sequestration in different ways, in crop production, in soil carbon sequestration, etc. You can really switch to no-tillage, and you can switch to a lot of other practices with relatively ease, and there is quite a lot of potential there. There is a lot of potential to use the carbon sequestration as a way to secure income to poor people in developing countries. So, to some extent, carbon sequestration can be a mechanism not only to sequester carbon, but also to ensure people moving to more sound environmental practices, and also to transfer income to areas that are relatively poor. So I think that would be a really interesting research challenge in this program.
Thank you. Next, will projects in the social science component be selected by the competitive solicitation process described for science and technology research?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. This is for Carol. My fear is that EBI may develop a breakthrough technology, but that this may never make it to the market if it doesn't fit with BP's business. If BP is guaranteed an exclusive license, what ensures that the technology goes to market?
So, under an exclusive license, you saw under the principles that we have an obligation to meet the public benefit. So under an exclusive license, given that we're giving the license to a patent that lives for a long time, we need to have two mechanisms in there to make sure that commercialization actually occurs. And one is due diligence. There's a whole section in an exclusive license saying you'll do this by such and such a year and that. of intellectual property. When you do grant an exclusive license to a company, the best thing to say is that because it's often early stage technology and neither we nor the licensee can envision all potential market uses of a technology. If a third party comes to us and requests access to that patented invention, but our answer is, sorry, it's been exclusively licensed, then we approach the licensee and say, company X or individual Y says, this is actually good for, bicycle grease or something. And then we ask the licensee, will you either take it up and then diligently pursue it, or will you, if you're neither interested nor capable of commercializing that particular field, then they must mandatorily grant a sublicense to the third party. And that way, no potentially unanticipated use at the time of licensing will fail to be addressed.
Here's one that I remember wondering about myself a little while ago. What is corn stover?
Stalks and leaves of the corn plant.
If this deal is about reducing climate change, then why are the two labs in the proposal dedicated to enhancing the use of fossil fuels? It is entirely possible that the technologies developed in these labs would help BP pump and sell fossil fuel that would enhance climate change far more than biofuels may reduce them, especially given the scientific uncertainties surrounding their potential climate impact. Note, one lab is focused on making liquid fuels from coal, and the other focused on developing synthetic bugs to enhance oil recovery and make currently uneconomical oil reserves economic to exploit. Both of these were mentioned in Dr. Chu's talk as things to be worried about.
There is part of the proposal which wants to use biological techniques to enhance oil or natural gas recovery. Those actual same techniques could be used actually for carbon sequestration. You could say, well, if you're going to enhance oil recovery, isn't this a bad thing? Yes and no. Conventional oil recovery, right? Let me start again. 30 to 40% of the oil in an oil reserve can be taken out of the ground typically, but the rest is in the ground. And what we're doing now is going to unconventional sources of oil, which are much more energy intensive. And so it's like saying, well, coal plants are very bad, I agree. But if a coal plant is 40% efficient versus a coal plant is 20% or 25% efficient, you actually do improve the situation. So in enhancing recovery from known existing wells, which don't require as much energy, or natural gas that don't require as much energy or produce as much carbon, it's not as bad as it sounds. It's not ideal, but the major focus will be on what we talk about biofuels.
So Steve mentioned during his talk that, or he may have mentioned that the largest point source of CO2 on the planet is a coal gasification plant in South Africa. So that process for making liquid fuels from coal is very carbon intensive, and I think there's a legitimate question as to whether there are innovations in biology that can be used to process fossil fuels to, like coal, to liquid fuels or gases that are more carbon neutral or lower carbon intensity, I think is the way it's saying.
So the work is very consistent. It's decreasing the amount of carbon given what we're doing today. You can't just say in the abstract you can't do this because it does emit carbon dioxide. If we're trying to improve what we're doing today.
This is, I think, representative of a number of questions. What binding power do the social and environmental studies coming from EBI have? If a UCB study found that GM biofuels caused health defects, how will that university research impact BP's obligations to our partnership?
I think that the best way to answer that is that all the research done by the social scientists will be published and will be available to everybody to read. I think that's the main way that those studies will have broad impact.
I think basically one thing that really assures people that we'll do the best, that, that we are in Berkeley and we really want to publish the best journals, and we would like to, and to some extent, BP or not BP, this is only a small part of our life, and you get some, you, there are other sources of support. So my feeling is that altogether we will be able to get data and to collect information to do research. But still, we wouldn't be BP University, it would be UC Berkeley.
There's a very specific question for Steve about the timeline, which I had here a moment ago, which I've lost. Basically, it says, here it is. When did you, Stephen Chu, first know of a possible call for proposals from BP? And question two, given that Berkeley, with all its top scientists, had a reasonable likelihood of being considered for EBI proposals, what would have been the harm in holding a small public consultative forum in August or September on a potential proposal?
I think we learned of a possibility in June, is my recollection, of that BP might be interested in both partnering with the university and might be interested in us. The timeline that was given, I think, is accurate. And what was the other part of the question?
Why, I guess, given that there must have been a reasonable likelihood of being considered, what would have been the harm in holding a small public consultative forum in August or September on such a potential proposal?
I don't think there would have been any, I don't think there would have been any harm. I think if you look at back the timeline, there were letters sent to the deans, department heads, in the various areas in the early September, to all deans. So we began to inform. This was mostly Beth. It was not me, but in terms of the campus connection. But it was, there was no real intent at all to hide this. It was, so it was going forward as soon as we knew that there was a possibility that we might be asked to put in a proposal.
There's 65 deans. Areas.
Next question, it's not specifically aimed, perhaps I'll ask Jay to start. How would you respond to the allegation that the proposed role of BP on education and student resources is simultaneously propaganda and exploitation of student labor?
Untrue.
You thought I was only going to read the nice ones, right?
I actually think that there are many benefits of having industry involved in education and in the educational experience. Many of our students will leave here and be working in industry, whether that be for BP, another, or any other company. And having students get some experience and exposure to industry while they're undergraduates, I think, can be a really valuable to have. We don't intend to have BP teach all of our classes. We do intend to have BP to investigators to share their experiences so it can broaden the research experience of students here at the university.
Anybody else want to comment on this? Okay, thank you. You would be surprised if I didn't have this question, and I think I'm actually going to ask Beth Burnside to comment on the answer. What lessons have been learned from the Novartis agreement, and how are they reflected in the project? That's one question. Another related one, a recent Cornell faculty statement noted some academic institutions have had well-publicized problems with strategic corporate alliances. Berkeley and the Novartis arrangement is the classic case. What has the administration done to avoid the difficulties and drawbacks associated with that agreement?
Well, for one thing, as soon as we heard about the BP agreement, we made a public effort to the faculty, the dean's chairs and directors memo requesting people to say whether they're interested in participating went to all faculty at Berkeley. And then 60 faculty sent in their list of interest. So it was broadly inclusive in the process, even with the praise short. And also, the other thing that I did was immediately in early in August, started meeting with the CAFRA, the Committee on Academic Planning and Resource Allocation of the Faculty Clinic, to keep them apprised of the development of the proposal and how we were doing it. Actually, Cal Moore is here, who's chair of that committee. He said he would say something today.
Yeah, since this has been an issue, I'd just like to comment on the Senate consultation that in August, Beth came to my committee, the Committee on Academic Planning and Resource Allocation, also to the Committee on Research. These are the two natural committees, I think, that would be involved in the consultation. I just comment from my own committee. I felt that the consultation was entirely proper, thoroughly transparent from our perspective. Transparent, of course, it's a moving target, but Beth met with us a number of times. And I felt that at least my committee and the Miguel Villas-Boas, who's the chair of the Committee on Research, felt similarly that the consultation was transparent. And I guess one problem was that the consultation with the Budget Committee concerning the FTE allocations was somewhat delayed, but once that consultation took place, the Budget Committee said that they were completely satisfied with the consultation and the plan going forward. So there was, I think, Senate consultation in the way, if I'd been in Beth's shoes, I would have done it. That is to contact the key committee chairs and keep them thoroughly posted, ask for comments. We received a copy of the proposal before it was submitted and invited, asked to submit comments.
Thank you, Cal. This is a four-part question. Can you please highlight some of the past research that's been done on biofuels that you might use as a starting point, which leads to how is this research effort different from what others have done before? What are some of the technical and adoption barriers you anticipate you may face? And then the last one, given the distance between UIUC and Berkeley, what will be the extent of interaction between the two universities? Maybe we can take the first three and then go back to the last one.
So maybe I can comment on some of the past research in biofuels. A lot of the research has focused on starch-based ethanol, so ethanol from corn. And we've come a long way in that, but as Chris pointed out, there are a lot of problems with ethanol. We think it's time to think beyond ethanol. We also think it's time to think beyond starch, and there are a number of challenges in doing that. And then Chris himself has also been involved in the other side of the coin, and that is how plants actually make cellulose and sequester cellulose in the cell wall.
I'd like to address that. So the one question is, how is this effort different from what others have done before? I would say there's two main things that we think would be different. One is the scale of it. That has been very difficult to obtain funding to work in this field. So very little has actually been done. And the other thing is that it's always been done in isolation. So you may have at one university someone working on hot acid deconstruction, and at some other university somebody working on improving cellulases for degradation. And I think one of our goals is to really bring it all together into a single entity so that we can make sure that we are cross-informed. That is, so that the people who are doing deconstruction understand what the plant breeders are trying to accomplish, or the people who are testing different species so that they can actually see how the species perform, or the people who are working on enzymes can test various methods of deconstruction. So I think that has never been done before, and I think that's going to be probably the most productive scientific aspect of it. I don't think it's also, to be honest, ever been done at an institution of sort of Berkeley's preeminence in science and, well, in social sciences. So I think that we're hoping that we can, by opening it up to everybody, that we'll attract ideas from a very high-level community that of people who have not been involved in this before. So we're hoping to tap into the genius of the institutions in a way that I think has not been done, because it's been segregated. It's been a specialty that didn't attract a lot of money and has been mostly done in the back halls of some engineering schools. And we're bringing it out into the light, I hope, in some way.
The issue of adoption. And there is a lot of research on adoption of basically food plants, but understanding how the adoption of the industrial plants and developing the industry both together with the farming practice, that's something that is really new and really exciting. The other thing that at least in the area of the social science, there is a connection between Berkeley and Illinois, and obviously we don't have a lot of farmers here, so to some extent we get a lot of the data there, but in the past we already worked with some of the faculty there to study adoption processes, technology transfer, evolution of technology, etc. So I think this can be really a good area of collaboration between the campus.
Thank you, David. I think this is also for you, at least initially. Discuss the major risks of biofuel development on populations living in poverty and how these risks are avoidable.
Oh, I think that the one big point that I mentioned in my talk is that you see that the price of fuel is going up, and especially in other countries like India and Pakistan, you can see that a lot of people will be paid not to grow food crop, but to grow biofuel. So I think one of the big challenges is to develop inventory policies, to develop some counter incentives to assure productivity of food. And the other thing is not only to increase the productivity of biofuel, but to increase the productivity of food per se. To me, that is the biggest challenge of the biofuel paradigm, to make sure that people stay food, and this will have food, and this will be one of our biggest challenges. It's your policy and institutional design.
I just want to add to that I'm part of my side jobs is I'm co-chairing a study that's sponsored by 90 national academies around the world on how the world can transition to sustainable energy systems, and it's an international committee of 20 some odd people. And I got an appreciation of what these issues are in developing countries. There are many people in developing countries, mostly children, that would be going around scouring after fuel, twigs, branches, dried grasses for heating and cooking that sometimes could take several hours. We're not talking about deforestation. That happened years ago. The land has been denuded. The developing countries would like to know what to do and not to do what is being done today. And so a lot of the world poverty and angst going on in the world is directly tied to this energy problem. And so there's the hope that what we will be doing in this BP thing would be, as I said many times before, would address many of these issues worldwide, especially in developing countries.
Thank you, Steve. I think that leads us into the next question quite well. The first page of the EBI compares the possibilities and scale of impact to the Manhattan Project. The Manhattan Project was responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of civilians. Is this what we aspire to?
Obviously not. I think what might be Manhattan Project like is that this is a problem that crosses over many, many disciplines, that you have to take a full systems approach, that right now is being attacked in little bits and pieces, and it's very multidisciplinary, and quite frankly, because of the scale, you saw those numbers. In the United States alone, we're spending over $1 trillion a year on energy. This is also a very embedded industry. 85% of this stuff is fossil fuels. And so this is the magnitude of the problem. So in order to make headway and to do it in a timely way, which is the most essential part, it needs something of real scale. Actually, if you compare what industry spends, for example, to introduce a new drug to market, that's of scale $500 million to $1 billion, this is actually just the beginning, quite frankly. to what one would really need to get it out there in a timely way. But yes, we want to do a Manhattan Project in the sense we want to do the problem, but of course this, I think we would, none of us would be in this if we didn't think that deep down in our hearts it is very fundamentally a good thing.
Thank you. This is for Steve Selkowitz. Will the building standards and innovations discussed at the end be used to design the EBI building? It would be a shame if a research building dedicated to energy did not conserve energy itself.
I think that's certainly the goal. I believe is a meeting next Tuesday and Wednesday that involved the staff of the EBI building and some people from our division to talk about what those goals are. That's certainly our hope, and we'll make sure that our colleagues do that.
We've actually had discussions with BP and told them that in a very straightforward way, and they're very supportive of this, that we do want to make this building a model of energy efficiency.
Okay, back to a bit more contentious topics. The USDA study that Chris Somerville referred to has some very tenuous assumptions, including a 50% further increase in productivity of some crops, amongst others. Also, even with this assumption, the study only predicts that all biofuels will replace only 30% of transportation energy and therefore reduce only 10% of U.S. CO2 emissions. We can reduce 10% of U.S. emissions tomorrow by improving vehicle fuel efficiency standards to Japanese standards. It would be useful if Dr. Sago could present all the facts, not just selective material. I think before I ask Chris to answer, again, Steve, I think I'd like if you can say something about vehicle emission standards or vehicle mileage standards. Steve Selkowitz, unless...
Do you want me to go first? You said one.
Yes, first.
Well, that's an area that has a lot of potential. The technical part of it is, I won't say straightforward, but there are many opportunities. You watch Congress's activities, and they've been really slow, unfortunately, to move forward in that. They've proposed a few marginal tightenings that are quite small. I think there's a huge amount of activity on the technical side, looking at hybrid vehicles, looking at plug-ins. There's lots of excitement about linking hybrid vehicles with homes and using PV on a home to charge the hybrid and using the power in a hybrid and a battery to run the home at times. So there's lots of interesting talk and discussion going on about making those systems work. On the standard side, that's driven by Congress. You all vote, I hope, and you should write letters where it makes a difference. I do see, as I showed in my last slide, things are changing back there. There are embedded interests on both parties to keep the vehicle world as it is. I think sooner or later, once people start to understand what the alternatives are and see that connections that we're talking about here, I think that will change, and I just think it needs more public pressure. There's also a lot of pressure coming from overseas. You just have to look at Asia and Europe and look at what's possible. So I think it needs work on the public policy side, and we should all be part of that process.
I just want to address the other part of it. The USDA DOE study actually projected that we could produce two-thirds of 130 billion gallons, which is almost two-thirds of our energy or liquid fuel use. The Secretary's goal is only 30%, so approximately half of what the billion-ton study predicted. I also mentioned, but only in passing, that I had some issues with that study, and I agree that there's lots of assumptions in it that I don't actually agree with, and I only offered it as an indication of just an independent analysis of what's really possible. I believe that the future is not going to be reuse of crop residues, but actually is more likely to be dedicated energy crops of the type that I referred to.
Thank you.
Actually, I just want to make a statement. The mileage efficiency is a very high priority, and if you can, any pressure you can exert on the lawmakers in Washington to say, yes, we've got to get our mileage efficiency up to European and Japanese standards is great. No one disputes that. In fact, I think we all agree that. That is low-hanging fruit.
Well, I'm sure that everyone who has spoken today is a good person. who is genuinely concerned, a good person who is genuinely concerned about climate change. On the other hand, do you understand why some of us are morally uncomfortable with this collaboration with BP, the corporation that's responsible for a significant fraction of global carbon emissions? It appears to be addressed to Dr. Chu.
I don't see that it's BP who's responsible for those emissions. I think it's actually rests on the shoulders of every person who burns fuels, to be honest. Secondly, I actually consider it a tremendous opportunity to be able to do something with BP, because I've been a professor for 30 years and, you know, published many papers, and I can say there's a long, as Carol tried to allude to, there's a kind of a long and difficult process between discovery and actually making a change, and I think, I feel as Steve does, that there's some urgency to actually try and make change in how energy use takes place, and so I think that the best way of doing that is to have a partnership like this with a world company that can take innovation from a couple of the great universities and move it more rapidly towards the market. But that's actually the only way that we can really make change in the energy economy. So there are some risks. There are always risks in such a relationship. And we all, I think, understand that. But I would hope that the Berkeley community would have, in particular, enough confidence in the processes and the people that are here, the community itself, to say that we can handle that risk. I take the optimistic side of that risk rather than the pessimistic side. I guess that's what I would hope other people would do.
I would also add that BP was the first oil company to actually break ranks with the rest of the oil companies and say, yes, climate change is happening, humans caused it, and we've got to do something about it. Then Royal Dutch Shell followed. There are other oil companies who are still trying to muddy the waters for climate change. So I think you can't paint with the same brush all these oil companies, just as there are now power companies like Duke who are now saying, we've got to do something about the carbon emissions of our coal plants, and are now advocating a carbon cap and trade system in the United States. So have BP come forward and say, you know, would you partner with us is, to my mind, wonderful, because this was the leadership company in recognizing that climate change is a serious problem and we're all responsible for it, all of us who use energy, and I think that's most of us.
Dr. Somerville has been associated with Mendel Biosciences. Will he maintain that association after he assumes a role in the EBI?
If I assume a role in the EBI, Berkeley will make sure that whatever my associations are, they pass the ethics and conflict of interest committees. If necessary, I'll separate myself from the several companies that I'm associated with.
I think I will again refer this to Beth Burnside. Why did the very interesting timeline offered this audience omit the February 12th advertisement purchased by BP in the Wall Street Journal, an ad beginning the greenwashing with which the university is now involved?
The billionth acre of GE crops was planted last year, and
no one's ever gotten a rash from it. So I think what you know, we know quite a lot about GM crops. Nevertheless, this is not about GM crops. I feel, based on my knowledge of GM crops, I don't see how it's possible that there could be a genetically modified plant, other than the ones that are already out there, used for biofuels within 10 years. It's certainly, I've been involved in making genetically modified crops, and I can say that I've been working for 10 years and have invested or used very large amounts of money, $100 million at least. It's still at least 5 years till the first plant from that process can reach the market. We're currently in a five-year regulatory process with the first of those plants. So it's a very long process. The kind of plants that we envision using for biofuels are, there's so much to be done with just traditional agriculture and agronomic practices that I don't see GM technology being applied as a major priority anytime soon. Our goal is to simply try and learn how to propagate and plant and cultivate and harvest plants that are essentially wild now and are going to be used in that condition in the, certainly the first generation. Will they ever be GM? You know, my personal conviction is that every plant used by humans will eventually be GM because it's the only way of applying knowledge about basic mechanisms to plant improvement. So, you know, 100 years from now, yeah, I think everything will be GM. Anybody else?
Well, I think this one may be for Jay. It's a little hard for me to follow, but I think the question is the enzymes, the synthetic enzymes, I don't think they're synthetic, but anyway, the enzymes in the termite guts are taking apart lignin in Miscanthus or poplar. Why will this not also go after the lignin in other trees or cellular plants?
Well, first, most of these enzymes are added in the process. So Chris put up a process, and actually I think Steve did as well, a process diagram. And so you grind up the plants, or in the case of starch, you actually take the starch and you mash it, the corn, and you mash it and grind it, and then you add the enzymes to it. So you don't have an organism necessarily producing the enzymes, the same organism producing the enzymes as producing the fuels. The enzymes are added. One can envision that the same process will be like that for cellulose. We'll be recombinantly producing those enzymes. So we'll take the gene, say, from an organism like these bacteria that live in the termite gut. We would express that, produce a lot of the protein, but then that protein would be added in the process. So I think that's most likely how those enzymes will be added. But as Chris also pointed out, we're going to be looking at chemistry and can we mimic the process that the enzymes use in chemistry, because some of these chemical catalysts can be much more robust to processing conditions that you might use for wood or straw or dried miscanthus.
All right, I think we're down to the last two. I have one comment to make. How does EBI plan to enhance commercialization of any technologies developed besides cooperation with a single party, that is BP? Perhaps Carol would like to start, and then Chris or Jay would follow on, or Steve.
So for any technologies that BP is not interested or not capable of commercializing, then they would decline the opportunity, and we would either license to someone else, or if they are uninterested and there's a good reason why they're not, we might not patent to begin with, because we believe that the patent should be used in order to induce investment. So if a company doesn't need the patent to induce investment, maybe we don't have to protect rights. Also, I think BP might plan to partner with companies, but that wouldn't be our transaction.
Actually, we certainly, as part of the activities in the EBI, we hope to have a lot of workshops where people from the biotechnology and the business community from the region will be able to come and understand the science and technology program in the Institute. And we would hope that that would foster the kind of interactions that lead to startups and interactions between various companies with interest in the sector. BP has indicated that they're in favor of that, that they don't feel a need to dominate the field, that they see that as enabling the development of the infrastructure and the knowledge that will lead to the development of the biofuels industry. So I see it as actually good for the entrepreneurial community in the Bay.
Last two questions. What percentage of EBI's space at LBL will be rented to BP? And what percentage of the EBI governance board will be BP personnel? Deep Chu, want to stop?
The plans for exactly how much space is still unclear. As we go through the building design stages, it really depends. There's an upper limit in the proposal of how many researchers would be BP versus RES. The dominant fraction would be UC Berkeley or LBNL employees. I think it's an upper limit of 50 people. Not 50 PIs, I stress, 50 people from BP. And this is a building that's going to be a $160 million building. A very large building.
That would be about 10% of the people in the building.
Was it?
Yes,
the percentage of the government's board in the BP.
Actually, I don't know. Do you know?
In the proposal, you say 2 out of 5, and then the associate director is a BP employee, and BP gets to propose the director. So that's 4 out of 8.
Yeah, the director, the associate director, and the deputy director are not members of the governance. They're ex officio members of the governance.
Well, then you got 2 out of 5, the 2 BP employees.
That could be. But it hasn't been negotiated yet.
That's what you said.
That was
in the proposal, but it hasn't been negotiated yet.
Yes.
All right. I think we've reached a stage where the questions are redundant. I had one question here, which I'm going to read out, but I'm not going to act on, and I'm going to explain why. It says, "Dear Moderator, I'm curious about how this information session has changed or not changed opinions on the deal. Can you straw poll who in the room is comfortable with the UCBP deal and who is uncomfortable with it?" I think these are complicated questions. I think we need to all go and reflect on them. I don't think it would be a useful activity to turn this into a instant reaction. And so I wanted to know that question being asked, and I'm not going to follow up on that and ask for the vote. There's a late-breaking question. It has been stated that the research agenda, hiring, and other research sectors, such as critics of BP practices, will not be affected by this agreement. However, what is the exact process and procedure to ensure this? So ensure against the research agenda, hiring, and other research sectors being assured that they are not influenced by the agreement. Beth, do you want to? I'm only reading. It has been stated that the research agenda, hiring, and other research sectors, such as critics of BP practices, will not be affected by this agreement. However, what is the exact process and procedure to ensure this?
Approved at the governance board level. So, Beth, perhaps what they mean is others not involved in this project. How will the hiring of others not be affected? How will the criticism by others not be held against them?
Okay, so the hiring issue is that the executive committee will identify...
No, Beth,
let's say there's a department, a social science department, that says they want to hire Professor Watt, and that is against this whole arrangement.
Question
is, how will that be affected?
Okay, I can't imagine the budget committee being controlled by the executive committee or the VP in any way. I was trying to come at the issue that there may... I think there's concern that there may be an indirect effect on people's ability to hire in other departments if there is a commitment of these seven FTEs to the EBI proposal. That's what I was trying to lead up to. And I think that the way that is going to be addressed is that, as you heard, the deans of all of the colleges in which these positions lie have already expressed a commitment to move in that direction. So these will come out of the department's long-term allocations of FTE that actually ought to choose to hire people that go into the EBI. So as far as I can see, it will affect those departments in which they opt to hire someone that will be a part of the EBI, but it shouldn't affect anyone else on campus. And I can never imagine our budget committee being influenced by DP opinion or EBI opinion about who should be hired in another department.
All right, I think I'm going to draw this to a close. I want to thank everybody who spoke and everybody who asked questions.